there will be speakers and workshops for students interested in the implications of globalization. For more information on the conference, you can email studentglobalconscience@yahoo.com. That's studentglobalconscience@yahoo.com. This is Unwelcome Guests, and you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, W201CD Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, or KFAR, Knoxville. Today was Election Day in El Salvador, and an international contingent of election observers, including people from our community, are in that country trying to ensure free and fair elections. The ongoing problem of free elections in El Salvador is caused by the persistent efforts of the U.S. ruling elite to maintain a right-wing, corporation-friendly environment in El Salvador. And its present efforts in that direction involve some of the same U.S. operatives behind the coup in Haiti. I'd like to read you an article published Friday on ZNet titled, "Why Wait Until After the Election to Begin the Coup?" by Gar Lipow. He wrote, "This Sunday, March 21, 2004, El Salvador will hold national elections. Until recently, the FMLN, the moderate-left opposition in El Salvador, was ahead in public opinion polls, leading ARENA, the far-right government party. Recently, the polls, conducted exclusively by media sympathetic to ARENA, have shown the right leading. However, ARENA seems not entirely confident of this. Last week, around 80 international observers, mostly U.S. citizens, were detained by Salvadoran immigration. All were released, though another 14 were deported back to the U.S. Wednesday of this week, another 60 were detained. As of the writing of this article, CISPES, Committee in Solidarity with the People of El Salvador, believed that all 60 had been released, but had not yet obtained confirmation from human rights groups in El Salvador. Why harass international election observers unless you do not believe you could win the election by fair means and intend to steal the election?" As another sign that ARENA is not as confident as it portends, it has begun the usual tactic of threatening mass closure of factories weeks earlier than normal in a Salvadoran election. Since late February, employers have called workers into meetings and told them not to expect their factories to open for work if the FMLN is elected. In Salvadoran politics, this is typically saved for the last workday before the election. It appears the U.S. is concerned, too. According to CISPES, U.S. intervention in the electoral campaign began as early as June of last year. That was when former Ambassador Rose Likens publicly questioned the leftist FMLN party's commitment to democratic principles and accused its leaders of celebrating the September 11th terrorist attacks. Then, in February 2004, Assistant Secretary of Western Hemispheric Affairs for the U.S. State Department, Roger Noriega, a familiar name in the Haiti coup, was in El Salvador where he canceled a meeting with the FMLN presidential candidate Shafik Handal and called on Salvadorans to vote for someone who, quote, "shares our vision and values," close quote. Well, speak for yourself, Roger Noriega. And it is, of course, not likely that El Salvador, which is dependent upon U.S. aid and trade, would arrest U.S. citizens without at least tacit support by the U.S. government. In fact, in the midst of the recent crisis, Otto Reich avoided saying anything about these mass detentions, but did find time to claim that, quote, "the FMLN has fraternal relations with terrorist governments and groups," close quote. He added that the FMLN sustained a relationship with ETA, the Basque separatist group, thought by some at the time responsible for the recent bombings in Spain. And I might add, falsely thought. Referring to the presidential election scheduled for March 21st, he continued, "I don't think this would lead to good relationships between the United States and El Salvador if the FMLN wins." Reich then stopped short of fully endorsing the Arena Party, stating he wanted to recognize all that Arena has done for El Salvador. Close quote. So far, observers have not yet been harassed once they made it inside, but there are indications that this is at least being considered. According to CISPAS, the Midday News today cited a case of elections observers going out to the free trade zones to interview maquiladora workers as a case of observers using their observer status to do, quote, political work. Despite the less than warm welcome from the right, election observers from the U.S., Latin America, and Europe continue to pour into the country. Physical attacks on FMLN activists and threats of violence also continue. In Usultan, an FMLN activist was injured when Arena, quote, activists, attacked him and threw rocks, hitting him in the face. The attacker was later arrested. The CISPAS delegation was witness to an attack on Wednesday morning on the STISS headquarters. Early in the morning, a group of people dressed in red T-shirts went to the STISS offices to hang an Arena flag. Later in the morning, they returned, and the assailants attacked the union headquarters with rocks, bricks, and an explosive. The situation was immediately controlled by the STISS members, and nobody was hurt. There are reports that Arena is hiring young people to put on red T-shirts and go out and commit violent acts. The attacks and threats of more violence from Arena have served to double the observers' commitment to accompanying the Salvadoran people on the 21st in order to help assure fair elections. The latest U.S. pressure favoring the Arena far-right party was a press conference in which Representative Thomas Tancredo from Colorado outright threatened the poor of El Salvador by saying that he would work to, quote, control remittances if the FMLN wins these elections. Remittances are the monies Salvadorans working in the USA send back to their families, something many in El Salvador have become dependent upon. Tancredo also said, quote, under an FMLN presidency, the U.S. government would not have a trustworthy counterpart that would satisfy our legitimate concerns about national security, especially our concerns about the risk that support groups for the FMLN, like the FARC, represent, close quote. Will this succeed? Will Arena be able to steal this election? Or will threats from the U.S. terrify the people of El Salvador into keeping the right-wing government that serves the interests of the U.S. government and capital? We won't know for certain. One sign that people may not be intimidated is that on Saturday, March 13th, there were 50,000 people in San Salvador. On Monday in Santa Ana, a reported 30,000. And on Tuesday in San Miguel, another 20,000. And on Wednesday in Usultan, there were nearly 25,000 people at the final campaign event. On the other hand, the people of El Salvador know these threats are not empty. The invasion of Iraq, the attempted coup in Venezuela, the recent coup in Haiti, the memory of the torment of the people of Nicaragua when they elected a government that displeased the U.S., tells the people of El Salvador what they will face if they elect a government that displeases the U.S. government. So far as of March 19, 2004, this story has not reached any of the mainstream English-language press, not even the news services. You may want to call your local newspapers to ask why not. If they want resources for information on this, they can call CISPAS at 212-465-8115. 212-465-8115. Journalists can get the U.S. government side from the State Department, as they always do, the writer says. And he closes the article by suggesting that tomorrow, Monday, regardless of who wins, you may want to contact the U.S. State Department to let them know you are displeased with U.S. interference in what was supposed to be a democratic election. If the FMLN wins, you may want to express opposition now to economic warfare against the people of El Salvador and U.S. funding of armed opposition groups. You can reach the State Department at area code 202-647-6575. And that was an article published on March 19th on ZNet called "Why Wait Until After the Election to Begin the Coup?" by Gar Lipow. Also this weekend, demonstrations against the occupation in Iraq took place in more than 200 cities worldwide. In the U.S., the largest demonstrations were in New York City and San Francisco, with estimated turnouts of 50,000 people in each place. But one of the most significant demonstrations took place in Fayetteville, North Carolina, home to Fort Bragg, one of the largest domestic military bases. The demonstration, which drew several thousand people, was organized by anti-war veterans and military families opposed to the war in Iraq. Stan Goff, who is both, and who we've heard from on several occasions on this program, was one of the organizers of the event. Goff is a retired Special Forces officer whose career spanned from the Vietnam War to the U.S. invasion of Haiti in the 1990s. During his term of service, he gradually came to realize that the role of the military was different from the popular conception, and he has devoted himself to building alliance between soldiers and radical movements. What I'm going to play for you next is Goff talking about his experience during the Vietnam War, the resistance movement within the military during that war, and the way that military groupthink changes individuals in ways that make atrocities both commonplace and acceptable. Goff was speaking with Martin Smith last January about the Soldiers' Rebellion during the Vietnam War.
When I was in, and I came in January 1970, there was already an emerging Black Power movement in the United States, and the echoes of that Black Power movement were in the military, in the consciousness and actions of Black soldiers. There was a draft that was raising a lot of class contradictions about who got deferments and who didn't, and just the general progress of the war at that point was such that it was pretty easy to recognize for people on the ground that they were involved in something that could go on and on and on and on with no resolution. So the resistance to that on the ground was very individuated, and it wasn't, I don't think it was perceived by the people who were involved in it in many cases subjectively as resistance. It was just them responding to a situation that had become unbearable in a lot of ways. And a lot of times they turned that anger and frustration on themselves. The interesting thing that I read recently in a thing called Olive Drab, the majority of the resistance came from the volunteers. The speculation about that is that the volunteers were the people who went in, were people who were raised in families that were political and progressively so, tend not to be as shocked when they discover certain realities about public policy and international relations and social realities that are sort of behind those things. And a lot of people really believed that they were going to Vietnam to defend the United States. And regardless of how preposterous that sounds right now, you have to understand the climate back then. I mean, it was a post-McCarthy era, and people really did believe that you know, they believed in the domino theory. They believed in the world communist conspiracy and all that. And you know, they there were also all the beliefs that are still out there that are not much talked about, that drive males, you know, to seek to actualize their masculinity in the context of the military. All those other things. The folks that went in the military believing that they were doing their duty and believing that the United States was the best of all possible worlds, and not understanding much about the world, suddenly were given this very traumatic education, and so they came back enraged and prepared to give that rage an organizational form. If you haven't seen it, you need to go pick up an old movie called The Green Berets. It was John Wayne, of course. That movie was sort of iconic back then, not because it so much, you know, put special forces as a group on a pedestal, but because it was believed to be a snapshot of Vietnam, you know, where there were these deviant communist people in the black pajamas, as they said, they were going around doing all these underhanded things, and the good Americans that were over there trying to rescue these people's opportunity to vote or whatever. Raised back then, when, you know, and I came from, my mom and dad were both working in a factory, so, you know, I guess technically we were working class, but we had a very middle class existence, you know, because that was a time, they were both, they were working in a defense contractor's factory, both members of the IAM, they were making a decent wage, and, you know, we had a whole neighborhood of, you know, at least adequate ranch houses, and everybody there worked in the same place, and we sort of bought the whole Ozzie and Harriet thing. You know, we didn't see behind that, and because we were living in our own little world, we didn't, you know, we thought that all this stuff that was going on with the civil rights movement and all that stuff, this was just some minor disturbance in the background. So we were, you know, just weren't feeling that stuff on our skins. So you know, you go over with this sort of simple moral cosmology. And then the first thing that the very first person I saw killed in Vietnam was an old woman that my own platoon had gone down and murdered while she was hoeing her potato patch as vengeance for someone who'd been killed with a booby trap a couple weeks earlier. You know, it was like, we're gonna go kill a dink for JoJo. So they went and found somebody that was out there doing something with no witnesses, and they shot her down. To follow through so that they wouldn't be subject to a MACV investigation, they cooked up a story, they told it to the lieutenant, who knew they were lying but had to go along with it. It went back to the headquarters. A colonel came out and congratulated the platoon on their kill and said, okay, well, now we've got to, you know, follow procedure. So they tied her body to a rope and put it out on the LZ because it was drawing flies with a poncho over the top of it outside our perimeter. And that was, the rope was so that, because they said the VC came to steal their bodies back at night. Of course, this old woman wasn't VC. She was just an old woman over there. But they, at that point, they had people that were assigned as investigators because it was in the wake of My Lai, to at least give the impression that they were following up and trying to prevent war crimes. So there were little mini My Lais that went on in Vietnam all the time. But see, I you know, watched it at first, because I didn't go on the patrol that went down the ville and killed the old woman. You know, they came back and told the lieutenant the official story. They said she threw a grenade at us. You know. And so, you know, me, I'd watched the Green Berets and so, oh, you know, she threw a grenade at him. Because that's really what I wanted to believe. But, you know, there was something that wasn't right about all that and the way that people were behaving. It didn't take me very long. About 24 to 48 hours, I figured out that these guys had just gone down there and murdered an old woman, you know. And it wasn't like, it wasn't an abstraction. Her body was laying right out there next to where I slept. That's a quantum shift. That wasn't a political experience for me. That shattered my entire worldview. Everything that I ever knew at that moment was wrong. And so, you know, I had to go back and reconstruct it from the ground up. In the situation that I was in, surrounded by the people I was surrounded by. that's what I became part of. 3 months in country, and I was no different than anyone else. I had dehumanized the Vietnamese. That was my world then. That's what people came, and people still come back from combat experiences like that. You know, you put something back together, but it's not what you had before. You know, and it makes you, it doesn't make you conscious so much as it just makes you mistrustful. You know, you find yourself having a difficult time sort of believing anything except, you know, what you can see right in front of you. It's being exposed to all the possibilities of human action. Yeah. And that's, I'm not sure how else to describe that. And the thing about it that a lot of people don't, because it sounds like it's something that's really bizarre and something that's completely detached from everyone's experience, but this is not something that that just happened to one person that was peculiar. It happened to all of us. It happened to all of us. It happens to everyone. You put any human being in the same circumstances, and chances are something similar will happen to them. So it's not. It's not atypical. This is just what happens to people. What was shocking about it was the simplicity of it. I'm not sure how else to say that. The most shocking thing, I think, about taking human life is the banality of it. Because nothing really happens. You know, you're sort of led to believe that this is like the ultimate taboo. You know, then you transgress that taboo and nothing happens. The clouds don't gather, the lightning don't strike, nothing happens. You can go eat. You know. And once you're there, you don't go back. You don't go back. Everybody in life at some point, you know, like, confronts their mortality. You see what I'm saying? But this is something a little more, and it's kind of hard to describe. And a lot of people go there, and this is something we got to be concerned about now with all these kids coming back from Iraq. A lot of people go there and don't want to come back. They like it there. Is that people develop a kind of a thirst for that stuff. There is a peculiar kind of existential freedom associated with that. It's like the power of life and death, you know, and realizing it's just something in your head that keeps you from doing things. It's not real. There's no real barrier there. If I want to take your life, there's no real barrier there. It's just a question of, you know, are you willing to do it? And oddly enough, if you are willing to do it, people leave you the fuck alone, you know. When I got there, I was really scared. Not scared. After the incident with the old woman, I wasn't scared of, you know, the enemy. I was at least as respectful and frightened of my own colleagues, you know, because now you're in a situation where, you know, you're sharing information about, you know, thrill kills, murders and stuff like that, and, you know, you don't want to be a rat. That'd be a pretty dangerous profession, being a rat, you know. You know, so you find ways to blend in, and it didn't take me very long. It didn't take me very long, and I thought I was like this, you know, this person with all this integrity, you know, and this sense of fundamental morality. And, you know, I was in country maybe 3 weeks before I started burning people's houses down.
Were there other soldiers that didn't take part in this, and were they ostracized?
Yeah, some. You find your niche in those situations because, you know, these are all personalities. It's not like, you know what I mean? It's not some sort of a universal situation. There's some universality in how this transformation of people happens in a situation. And you know, looking at it now, clearly the structural situation, we were a military occupying force. This is a phenomenon that is common to all military occupying forces. The necessity, you know, of overcoming the cognitive dissonance, of dehumanizing the people that you're required to basically serve as a turnkey over, and in the process of dehumanizing them, you know, it sort of grants TASS permission to do virtually anything to them. Israeli soldiers experience this all the time. We experienced it in Haiti, and people are experiencing it in Iraq and Afghanistan right now. It was a community of survival, and you know, it was more than that. We also, you know, people developed some real emotional attachments to one another. It wasn't like, again, you know, we didn't all turn into Jeffrey Dahmer or anything. We were still humans. That's the part that people had to get their heads around. You know, we were still humans, and we still shared all those forms of human intercourse. The way that we did stuff to Vietnamese was we just excluded them from the human family. That's the way you do that. You know, you hear these stories about people who ran the extermination camps in World War II who would doted over their children. You know, that's not hard to understand. That's not hard to understand. As long as you reduced everybody outside, you know, your definition of the human community is someone that's less than, you know, someone who's the other, then it's easy to do that. People had different ways of accommodating that situation over there, and the situation was different on racial terms as well. You know, African American soldiers had a very strong sense of solidarity over there, and they tended to stay among themselves. Now, there was a lot of interaction, especially with the field troops. The grunts, they had a lot fewer direct racial conflicts than the people who were back on the fixed installations and the bases and so forth. They were having some fairly regular race riots and stuff going on back there. I mean, real knockdown, drag-out fights. Or in the field, that wasn't as common. Little things flared up from time to time. But the black soldiers were being held to a collective standard among themselves, and they weren't being held to the same standards as white soldiers, who also had their own sort of, you see what I'm saying? I mean, there were all these, we didn't recognize this stuff while we were over there. And there were people who refused to participate in some of the things that were going on. But it was very, very, very seldom that they would ever, you know, cross the line and, like, inform on anyone. They just didn't do that. They just didn't do that. And they still haven't. They still haven't. I mean, some have, but most people haven't. And a lot of people have found a way to, you know, they found a way to justify it. It was like, it's what we had to do, that kind of thing. Yeah.
One experience I had in the military was there was a definite differentiation between the top NCOs and the younger officers. Mm-hmm. Were there tensions like that where you were? Were there instances where your unit disobeyed, perhaps, mm-hmm. or at times questioned that divide between officer and rank and file soldier?
Well, not only that, I mean,
by the time I got there, fragging was already a pretty common thing. Fragging when you kill an officer. I didn't. If I did, I wouldn't admit it, but I didn't. So, I mean, you can look in the record, none of my officers were killed. So I guess I'm scot-free on that. But, I mean, I know of some instances. It wasn't just, there weren't a lot of senior NCOs over there. A lot of the senior NCOs were working in the rear. And I can only speak for my unit now. I was in a light infantry unit, and we'd come together as a company every 4 days to set up an LZ, bring in resupply. Then we'd split back up into platoons, and then the platoons would establish patrol bases each day, and out of those patrol bases, we'd run the squads out on what we called hawk team ambushes at night. So that was... And we'd just do that over and over again. And they'd pick us up and CA us in. And so basically what we did was ride helicopters from one place to another and just walk, you know, like walk through the mountains and set these hawk teams up every night. So usually the highest ranking NCO that you were ever in contact with was an E5 or an E6, usually a young person. A lot of times there were people, you know, that we smoked dope with, you know what I mean? It was like... Yeah, with a few exceptions, but the officers were coming in. A lot of the officers, you know, most of us, our point of view was, we're getting through this tour. That's what you did. You counted your days down. You know, I got so many days to wake up, and then my ass is back to the world. where the officers are over there punching a ticket. You know, they're looking at this as a career move. To at least give them, not their due, but at least to put it in context, you know, officers that are running platoons are second lieutenants. They're 21, 22 years old. They're fresh out of college, been through the infantry basic course, and, you know, 3 weeks of jump school, and boom, here you are. And now you're supposed to go out here and command all these people. Many of them now, you know, some of them actually on a second tour and that kind of thing. It's like, so they didn't, you know, we disobeyed, blatantly disobeyed. You know, we had a lieutenant. We didn't do it all the time. It was infrequent. But I remember an instance. I can remember the day. It was April 4th, 1971. On April the 3rd, we had done a combat assault, helicopter assault, into a place called the Suikai, because our sister company, D Company, had gotten caught in a regimental-sized NVA ambush, and they were in a lot of trouble. So we went in there to bail them out. Had mortars hit the LZ, we came in, moved down off the hill. All squads were in contact within 5 minutes. It was like the place was just crawling. Got through the day, NVA picked up and ran. We chased blood trails until we were dehydrated. We ran out of water. And the following day, it was about 102 degrees, and we were still out of water. They didn't have any way at that point, because every time they brought a helicopter in, it get fired up by the 51s, and so they couldn't bring the Blivets in to drop us some water. We were stuck up on top of these hills. Every time we could try to go down off the hills, you know, we get hit. And our sister platoon, we knew where they were. They were down the hill from us, and had been in contact. In fact, had gotten pinned down for about 6 hours the day before. And the lieutenant told us to go out at dusk, because the way you'd move out on ambush is you'd move out at dusk, recon your site, and then go past it. So that, you know, you've looked it over, you go past it, wait till dark, and you move back in and occupy the ambush position. He told us to go down, you know, we're basically in the vicinity of this sister platoon. And it was like, no, because they would have shot us, which is exactly what we'd have done. It was a free fire zone. Anybody goes around and moving around. It was a dumb order, but I mean, it's that kind of thing. And it was like, fuck you, you know, we're not doing it. And there really wasn't very much he could do about it. You know, what's he going to do? He's got 30 people with guns, and he's going to tell them, you know, I'm going to make you go down there and commit suicide. We disobeyed order. But the commander at D Company, the company that we went to bail out on that operation, and gotten caught, it was his gung-ho shit that got them into their problem. He did some more gung-ho shit later on, and then mysteriously had his legs blown off with a Claymore mine about a month later. So I guess that was a form of disobedience, too. I'll never forget that. His name was Captain Ranger. Yeah, and he's a legless veteran if he's still alive right now. And last I checked, the NVA didn't have Claymore mines in their inventory. So the first 2 months I was there, we were on something called pacification in a place called Bongsan. And you know, it's called a VCville, which, you know, any place that, like, everywhere was a VCville, I guess. You know, it was an area where the Viet Minh resistance had been very strong all along. They didn't like us very much, and we gave them a lot more reasons to not like us by the way that we treated them. You know, like I say, you burn people's houses down, it has a tendency to piss them off. Shoot their livestock, that makes them mad. Kill their moms. The woman that we killed, she ended up being an Arvin lieutenant's mother. He was a lieutenant in the South Vietnamese Army. They came back 3 days later while her body had blown up on the LZ out there. Nobody come to recover it. And he'd been looking for his mother and heard about this. And we saw this guy just, like, fall apart. And he was an Arvin lieutenant. He was trained and equipped courtesy of the United States military. And I'd be very surprised if he didn't become VC right after that. I sure would have. You know, Americans go, like, kill my mom while she's on. you know, and claimed that she threw a hand grenade. This old woman couldn't have thrown a hand grenade 5 feet, you know what I mean?
You say you don't have first experience of the fraggings, but were you aware at the time that this was going on, and did you discuss this with other soldiers?
We talked about it all the time. Yeah.
How did you talk? Can you describe how you talked about it?
Well, I mean, you know, if your officer was doing stuff that was pissing everyone off, I mean, it was like, you know, I mean, you know, maybe he's going to accidentally walk out in front of a machine gun position. I heard guys talking about giving, you know, because, you know, they screw us over on our supply. There's a first sergeant in the rear that's responsible for that happening. He's being stingy or whatever. It's like, well, we go back there and stand down. We'll put some rat poison in his food. I mean, you know, we talked about that stuff all the time. But, you know, that, yeah, it's just the type of thing we talked about.
I'd like to ask you to maybe pass on any word you might have for soldiers today in Iraq.
Yeah, well, don't go there. I mean, you know, that's what I wrote an open letter to GIs here a while back and just told them don't go there. I mean, look, you take away someone else's humanity, you surrender your own, and the cost is too high. Yeah, the cost is too high. And some people can recover from that stuff, some people can't. And you don't want to go there, you know. There's some shit you don't want to walk around with inside your head, you know, especially stuff that you got a choice about right now. Regardless of what the peer pressure is, you know, recognize, you know, that those are not hajis and they're not ragheads. Those are people just like you, you know. And the other thing I would say to them is this is not the conflict between them and the Iraqis. It's not of their making, and it's not of the Iraqis' making. The people who created this situation are immune from its consequences right now. They're all up in Washington, D.C., you know, having a good meal and a cocktail and slapping each other on the back.
That was Stan Goff speaking with Martin Smith last January. Thanks to Dave Adelson of the L.A. Sound Posse for that tape. Frequently hears people say that we have the military to thank for our freedom. During my lifetime, it has invaded a variety of other countries to prevent those countries from having their freedom to decide how they wish to govern themselves. Korea, Vietnam, Colombia, Grenada, Panama, Haiti, Yugoslavia, Somalia, Afghanistan, Iraq, plus a bunch of covert operations and coups in Chile, Iran, Haiti, Nicaragua, El Salvador, Venezuela, East Timor, Zimbabwe. This is just during my lifetime, and it seemed none of those defended my freedom that I can see, though it did defend the freedom of some corporations to get cheap resources and labor and ruin the lives of the people in those countries. So what about our great freedom that we have here? Check this out. Tomorrow, the Supreme Court will hear the case of Nevada farmer Dudley Heibel. On the evening of the 21st of May in the year 2000, Dudley Heibel stepped out of his red 1988 GMC pickup truck and lit a cigarette. The pickup truck was parked on the side of Grass Valley Road, a rural stretch of asphalt that leads out of the mining town of Winnemucca into the rural cattle ranching area where Dudley lives and farms. The pickup had been driven by Dudley's 17-year-old daughter, Mimi, with whom Dudley had been having an argument over a boy Dudley didn't approve of that she'd been seeing in town. Mimi got mad at her dad and punched him in the shoulder. They continued shouting at one another as they drove back to the ranch, and Mimi eventually pulled over the truck after her dad said he wanted out. That's what Dudley Heibel was doing that May evening in 2000, standing on the side of Grass Valley Road, smoking a cigarette, his elbow resting on the rolled-down passenger window, talking with his daughter. Then the police arrived. Deputy Lee Dove of the Humboldt County Sheriff's Department came on the scene, siren a-wailing, in response to a domestic violence report. Someone saw Mimi arguing with her dad and thought it had come to blows. The witness said that he saw a man with a black cowboy hat who slugged the female. Dove was there to investigate the report. Everything that happened next was captured on the police videotape. If you think that the first thing Deputy Dove would do on the scene would be to make sure that the, quote, slugged female was all right, you would be wrong. Rather than investigate the complaint, Deputy Dove, who has twice had evidence he collected suppressed by the court, instead began to demand Dudley Heibel show his ID. 11 times Dove demanded Dudley show his papers. Dudley asked a simple question. Why? Because I'm investigating, said Dove. Investigating what? Dudley asked. I'm investigating an investigation, was Dove's non-reply. 11 times Dove demanded Dudley's ID, and when the deputy decided Dudley wasn't going to cooperate, he cuffed, then tossed him in the back of his patrol car. And it didn't stop there. Meanwhile, Dudley's daughter was watching the encounter between her dad and the law from the cab of the pickup truck. You can hear her screaming, no, as her father is being handcuffed. Another policeman, a Nevada State Trooper by the name of Mershall, was on the scene and was holding the door of the pickup truck shut so that Mimi couldn't get out. Screaming, she finally forced the door open, only to be thrown face down into the hard dirt by the side of the road by Trooper Mershall. A second trooper climbs on top of Mimi, and he and Trooper Mershall brutally pin 17-year-old Mimi to the ground and slap on cuffs. With Dudley Heibel arrested for refusing to show his ID, and his daughter Mimi beaten and in handcuffs, Deputy Lee Dove now comes over to talk to Mimi and investigate. Dudley Heibel was charged with domestic battery, battery, acts which constitute domestic violence, and obstructing, delaying a peace officer. As there was no battery or domestic violence involved, the only charge he was left with was delaying a peace officer. By refusing to show Deputy Lee Dove his ID, Dudley was fined $250. He's appealing it all the way to the United States Supreme Court. It is this very charge that is now coming before the U.S. Supreme Court tomorrow on the 22nd of March. The question before the court is this. Did Dudley's refusal to show ID give Deputy Dove the probable cause needed to arrest him? Or is it the constitutional right of every American to just say no when asked to produce the papers? Mimi Heibel was hauled off to juvenile detention and charged with resisting arrest. In court, her father asked the judge a simple question. What charge was Mimi arrested for resisting? The case was dismissed. And that was from the website www.papersplease.org, where you can find out more about this landmark court case and see the video of the arrest for yourself. We'll conclude the program with a brief reading from Disciplined Minds, A Critical Look at Salaried Professionals and the Soul-Battering System That Shapes Their Lives by Jeff Schmidt, published in the year 2000. This week, the conclusion of Chapter 14, Resisting Indoctrination. This chapter has been explaining the 8 characteristics of the totalist organization and how totalist groups use psychological methods to break the spirit of their recruits. Author Jeff Schmidt has been comparing these brainwashing techniques to the psychological pressure exerted on students in professional training programs. Point number 7, taking away true self-confidence. You can't become totally committed to an organization that you don't totally trust. And you can't trust an organization totally if there are occasions when you feel confident that your judgment is better than that of the group's decision makers, or that part of the group's doctrine is wrong. Hence, your self-confidence stands in the way of total commitment. Totalist organizations work to remove this obstacle. Leaders belittle members, usually by confronting them in areas where they feel insecure, in knowledge of the group's doctrine, for example, which one can never know deeply enough. Members end up with so little self-confidence that they trust the group, both its leaders and its doctrine, more than they trust themselves. As their time in the group increases, members become more and more confident when they are acting with the approval of group leaders or in accord with group doctrine, but less and less confident about taking initiative outside of that safe framework. They end up acting self-confident to the point of being arrogant or cocky, except where it matters most, in their dealings with the leaders of the group, the people who set their direction. Members check an increasing proportion of their life activities with group leaders. They become increasingly dependent upon the group, returning to a situation like that of the child under adult authority. This lack of true self-confidence causes members to ignore anomalies that challenge the group's doctrine. Whenever a world event or personal experience appears to contradict the organization's dogma, those without the self-confidence necessary to listen to their own intuition, let alone stand up to the leaders of the group, will discount their observations and stick to the doctrine. Members of totalist organizations show little spontaneity, imagination, creativity, or sense of humor, all of which grows out of self-confidence. Their lack of self-confidence also makes it difficult for them to leave the group. John told me what he saw graduate school do to the self-confidence of his fellow students, John said. Graduate school shook some. People felt like, gee, should I really be here? Some people had their self-concept challenged and their self-confidence at least questioned, if not challenged. Students with the right orientation ultimately had their self-confidence boosted. However, at the same time that these students got higher status and honor than someone like myself, they also learned that it's not a good idea to challenge the department chair or a committee member or a professor in class. There's a certain kind of deference that they learned at the university, a whole attitude of deference. It's probably a natural tendency among undergraduates that is reinforced in graduate school. I don't think they'd stand up to a big name. Whereas in a professional meeting, I might say, I don't care how many more books you've written than me. I still have a problem with what you're saying. They would defer more to that individual's authority, that individual's perspective. John saw the system give people confidence in proportion to their adoption of dominant values and their willingness to play a subordinate role. This confidence, of course, is not the true self-confidence that John had to develop to survive as an independent thinker. And the last of the 8 points of the Totalist Organization, the only path to salvation. Every totalist organization claims to be committed to one or another mission of supreme human importance. And each group views the work it is doing as the most important work being done by anyone, anywhere. Furthermore, the totalist organization believes that no one else grasps the principles that are the key to achieving the vital, personal, and social goals to which the group is committed. Hence, the individual, and indeed humanity as a whole, is doomed without the group and its insights. Members therefore feel an enormous responsibility to spread the word and recruit, and to do so urgently. They feel that the group's mission is more important than their own lives, and so with encouragement from their leaders, many work like slaves, even though that takes a physical and psychological toll. At the same time, they are arrogant and elitist toward outsiders. From the perspective of the most extreme totalist organizations, those who reject the group's truth stand in the way of humanity's opportunity for true existence and thereby forfeit their own right to exist. This belief establishes a heavy atmosphere in the group. It justifies extreme measures, especially against those who leave the group. In the condemnatory atmosphere, insecure or guilt-ridden recruits are drawn to a conversion experience as a way of establishing their right to exist. Leaving the group is seen as a sign of personal weakness that will have disastrous personal consequences, such as the end to personal growth, reappearance of prior personal problems, social failure, failure to get ahead economically, or failure to survive looming big changes in the world. Ted is a physicist who got his PhD at a university in the Southwest. He told me about the arrogant attitude of members of a research group there. The group specialized in the subfield of elementary particle physics, or high-energy physics. Ted's testimony. Our department decided to start a high-energy physics program, which would have a close connection with the SSC, the superconducting supercollider particle accelerator, which Congress later canceled. They hired a fairly good high-energy guy and later two more. One of the first things the head of the new high-energy group did was arrange a meeting with the grad students to introduce himself and his program. It was supposed to be a friendly get-to-know-each-other meeting, and I'm sure he wanted to try to use it as a recruiting tool. At the meeting, the first thing he said was, "I am here to bring this department into the 20th century. Not the 21st, but the 20th. Wow, this ticked off a lot of faculty when they heard about it. We did not have a big department, but we did have people doing up-to-date research, including a good group of solid-state physicists. But the high-energy physics people respected no one but the other high-energy physics people. They thought that high-energy physics was where all the new physics was going to come from, and that people in the other subfields were on a futile search. The way the high-energy physics people talked to us definitely led us to believe that they felt superior. They took an arrogant approach to everything, from the curriculum to the PhD qualifying exam to tenure decisions, all of which they wanted to control. They always said, 'Let us decide. We know what's best for the department.'" This is a direct quote. Whether they knew what they were talking about or not, the high-energy people tried to stop almost every person who came up for tenure. One person they tried to stop was one of the best in a major subfield and brought in the most money to the department. Their thinking was, why give this person tenure when we could get someone better, say a high-energy person? Most of the new high-energy people were junior in rank, yet they spoke their minds and told us how stupid we were. After insulting us, they asked us to help them support the SSC. They were almost in tears at times. And what was really funny, they did not have a clue as to how or why we were doing research in other fields. They always said, "What good is this?" They knew nothing about anything other than high-energy physics. Sheltered lives. Problems in the department weren't limited to the high-energy people. A lot of the faculty treated students unfairly and like children. They didn't respect us as human beings or as individuals. An extreme example was the abuse of Chinese students by Chinese faculty, who induced fear in their students and then made unethical demands on them. The department didn't stop even such extreme mistreatment. Despite the subordinating atmosphere, Ted took action that allowed him to maintain his dignity. Continuing with Ted's testimony. One day I said to myself, "What the hell? I've worked outside of school in the real world, and so I'm not going to be treated like a child." The straw that broke the camel's back was a relatively minor issue involving the department's seminar, which was a weekly talk attended by faculty and students. Students liked the spirit of the seminar, which was learning because you wanted to learn, and so we enjoyed hearing speakers from other institutions. This suddenly changed when an authoritarian faculty member became seminar coordinator and demanded that students write summaries of the talks. This did not go over well at all. So we, the students, decided to have a meeting of graduate students. We organized it and set a date. Word spread like wildfire, and soon the seminar coordinator was at our door, trying to head us off at the pass. He told us in no uncertain terms that he could do what he wanted with the course, and he wanted to come to our meeting. He was told that would be up to the students. The students said no. As the day of our meeting approached, pressure around the department started to show its ugly head. We learned later that a split in the faculty had developed, Some supported us 100% and wanted us to kick his butt, and others were amazed that we would even think of questioning a professor. No one acted openly to help us, but people did intervene to try to stop us. Some of the students got pressure from their advisors not to have anything to do with us. This united us more. At the meeting, we decided to fight the seminar and to form a physics graduate student union. The seminar coordinator told us not to threaten him. Some students caved in to the pressure and did what he asked, but our union took off. We elected a president, vice president, U.S. student representative, and foreign student representative. The union gave us an unofficial voice in the department and in how it was run. To keep us quiet on the seminar issue, the faculty pulled the new coordinator after just one semester, dropped the writing requirement, and even reduced pressure on students to attend. Ted's outside experience helped him see through the local powers that be. It helped him to imagine standing up to people feared by others and rejecting their totalist expectations. He could then take action. Here, then, in summary, is a list of symptoms of a totalist organization. Big promises, milieu control, unquestioned authority, guilt-tripping and shaming, total personal exposure, scientific quote-unquote dogma, taking away true self-confidence, the only path to salvation. Any organization that wants people to play an ideologically subordinate role, be it a professional training program, a cult, a military unit, or an employer, will use these techniques. But as we have seen, the organization doesn't always get what it wants. When any one of these subordinating features are present in an organization, intellectually honest people will recognize them easily. The hard part is mustering the courage to fight them. Hence, any successful resistance, such as that carried out by Ian, Rod, John, and Ted, should be publicized to inspire others. As we will see in the next chapter, even seemingly insignificant resistance can play a vitally important role in preserving one's identity. The four individuals quoted in this chapter are exceptional in that they survived professional training without adopting mainstream values. When I interviewed them, I discovered that all four had accomplished this in part by organizing and creating an alternative community. As we will see in the next chapter, this is not a coincidence. And I've been reading the conclusion of Chapter 14, Resisting Indoctrination, from the book Disciplined Minds, A Critical Look at Salaried Professionals and the Soul-Battering System That Shapes Their Lives, by Jeff Schmidt, published in the year 2000 by Roman and Littlefield. In our next reading, we'll begin Chapter 15 on Surviving Professional Training. For more info on Disciplined Minds, you can visit the website www.disciplinedminds.com. And to contact this program, visit our website, unwelcomeguests.org. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. One day and they'll kill me. Then I'll be gone. But that won't be my end. For my guns and my soul.